Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today as we visit with our guest, V.J. Pandian, horticulture agent and educator for UW Extension in Kenosha, Milwaukee, and Racine counties. And we'll talk with V.J. about how to garden in a changing climate. And, of course, we want to hear from you as well. What gardening questions do you have for him? Join in. Give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. V.J. Pandian, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Good to be here, Larry.
You know, you've been with Extension for quite a few years now, and I've been around for a long time, too. What kinds of climate changes have you seen in Wisconsin over your time here?
Well, I've been in Extension for more than 18 years now, Larry. Can you believe that?
It's amazing.
See, in this 18 years, I've seen actually, you know, from polar vortex that we had in 2012 and also in 2018-19, and some of the extreme dry conditions that we faced in the last decade. And, you know, but the last few years are something more dramatic. We are seeing a dramatic change in the climate in Wisconsin and Midwest. We are seeing some unusually mild winter. Extreme fluctuating, precipitations during the growing season. And one thing is sort of interesting to me is that as a gardener, I'm seeing a longer growing season, you know. That doesn't mean it has a stable temperature of precipitation,
Right.
So we seem to getting like an early spring, and the fall season seems to be extending a bit longer, And I hardly see sometimes the ground, whether it's going to freeze or not,
Yeah.
See, our recommendations, to when to cut down your fall-bearing raspberries or things like that has been changing quite a bit. So
yeah.
It's interesting, So we are already starting to, adapt our garden and landscape practices slowly to this changing climate.
You know, I just this morning saw a Wisconsin State Journal article about sugar maple tapping in western Wisconsin. It's literally a month earlier. I mean, it used to be middle of March, and now it's this year it was the middle of February. So it's just absolutely amazing. And now our growing zones were just updated. And that has some meaning for our gardeners.
Absolutely. I mean, we are about at least 1 month ahead. I mean, last week I saw silver maple. Some of the Freeman maples are in full bloom, actually. And so it's like, it's crazy. And again, you're right. The USDA the zone of cold hardiness has been shifted. So the entire southern part of Wisconsin, we used to be under zone 4. It has completely become zone 5. And the interesting thing is that the coastal line area, the shoreline areas from Kenosha, Racine, Milwaukee, Wozaki, the shoreline, has shifted to zone 6. So what does it mean, actually? So do we want to actually jump in and start planting some in a warmer season plants? No. As a gardener, I would tend to advise people to, be more cautious in trying to plant some marginally hardy plants, in their zone, because it takes actually one winter or one polar vortex, to kill some of those plants. They exhibit some more cautious in planting some of the marginally hardy plants, even though your zone might have been shifted. So that would be my cautious advice to gardeners and landscapers.
Really, gardeners like to experiment a little bit. So I'm sure there's going to be some experimenting with some of those zones that might be a test.
Absolutely. I mean, we are gardeners. We like to do all the trial and error trade-up type of thing. And, you know, you say, if you're going to plant, buy a bunch of them, you know, maybe you can experiment with one or two of them and plant them in a very protected spot, maybe, you know, next to the side of a building or between the trees, and see how they respond and behave, you know, over time. I mean, plants are very adaptive. You know, given the right conditions, you know, they are very adaptable. So, you know, one thing I would say is that as a gardener, you know, this is the time, actually, I find that, you know, the use of mulching has been very helpful because of this fluctuating temperature that we're having. Sometimes the ground heaves and let the cold air get in and kill some of the herbaceous perennials. So oftentimes I use some of those, you know, leaf compost or any kind of wood chip mulch or any kind of clean straw, you know, just to give them a buffer, you know, from protecting from the root zone. You know, I just do, you know, mulch around those plants. So that really helps a little bit in the fluctuating temperatures that we have right now.
Yeah. We have an email from CJ in Central Clark County, and he emailed to ask if it's okay to uncover roses now instead of waiting for the end of March or early April.
Well, that's a very good question. And I ask many gardeners, you know, we don't have a clear crystal ball right now when is exactly the spring is about to happen, you know, in ground. So the plants are already starting to bud out. I have some roses, actually. The buds are actually swelling, and some of the shrub roses actually are just about to bud out. It needs only a few days of warm 60, 65 degree temperature, you know, they will. So, you know, one thing I would say, if you do have any protective blanket or like a rose cone, which I don't recommend, remove them right away. So the key thing is protecting the graft union. If you have a hybrid roses, protecting the graft union. And say those things, I would tend to be more cautious. People traditionally mound those graft unions with some 12 to 18 inches of dirt. So I would not remove those dirt right now, okay? Let it warm up a little bit more, and then gradually I would actually remove those dirt. So, but if you do have any, like a blanket on top of your plant or a gunny bags on top of your plant or a rose cone on top of your plant, take them off.
BJ Pandy and our guest, Horticulture Extension Educator for Kenosha, Milwaukee, and Racine Counties. You can join in with your questions. You could email us, email address ideas@WPR.org, or give us a call, 800-642-1234, and we'd love to hear from you. Let's see. Bob in Medford emailed to ask, given limited snow this winter, will we see a different nutrient level in soils this spring?
Well, that is a very good question. I mean, in relation to that, so generally in the past, when we used to have a lot of snow cover on the ground, and when we don't have any, you know, greenery to protect those soil, like a cover crop or any type of ground cover, or even, you know, if you have an open land with no snow on it and no greenery on it, then in those cases, the topsoil gets easily eroded and causes actually some of those, you know, stormwater pollutions and stuff. And that really also causes some leaching of those nutrients as well, too. Now, you know, so in a way right now, you know, this if, without any, you know, lack of snow, I mean, the loss of the nutrients, especially the leaching effect, is going to be very minimal. So that's one good thing. But at the same time, you may also want to be, you know, very cautious about, you know, if you happen to have like, you know, flooding or any kind of like, a, you know, rainfall. Those rain, you know, can also leach some of those top soil. So my general suggestions for gardeners, especially if you have a community garden plot or if you have an open garden plot, in the fall time, put some cover crops just to hold those good top soil still intact in the ground, you know, and not let the snow or any of the rainfall, you know, to leach out any of those nutrients, okay?
Are there varieties that are being developed for warmer weather, or are we just going to take what Missouri uses?
So I mean, the plant breeders are breeding right now a lot of tough plants, and that is more suitable for our landscape as well as for backyard one. So, for instance, you know, in the last few years, I've been testing some of those, you know, trees in our Kenosha County Center. And during my last 3 years of, I mean, even though it's not like a, you know, a 12 years of test trial, even in the last 3 years, when we had this kind of like a dry conditions down in Kenosha, you know, in Bristol area, I was, you know, thrilled to see some of the tough trees. So one of the tough trees that I came across that really, you know, stood out in 2021 drought, that's like a 1 in 100 years we had this extreme drought down there, is the Prairie Sentinel Hackberry. And this hackberry is more like an upright columnar type, very, you know, perfect for like a small space landscape setting. And this particular one, Prairie Sentinel Hackberry, you know, withstood the drought and didn't show any dieback even to the any kind of cold winter temperature. And this particular plant, you know, is bred from Frank Schmidt Nursery. And this is an awesome plant. And now we have a barrage of, like, you know, oak trees right now. A lot of hybrid oaks are actually out in the market. And, like, in a American Dream oaks, Kindred oaks, beacons, there are a lot of different varieties of oaks right now. Oaks are native species. They're very tough. And some of the oaks are more like, you know, more upright columnar type. Some of them are medium size. So for different types of landscape settings, you know, you can also actually plant these tough oak trees as well too. Now, interestingly, now there is a new variety of Kentucky coffee tree. You all know Kentucky coffee tree is actually, you know, a native tree. And there is one Kentucky new variety called Skinny Latte, an interesting name. Skinny Latte actually, you know, has been commercialized through Frank Schmidt Nursery, but it was originally bred through Morton Arboretum. And this one is about 50 to 55 feet tall, 18 feet wide, and is more upright, skinny type. Perfect name for it. Say, usually, you know, Kentucky coffee tree gets so humongous. Now we have an improved varieties right now for like medium-sized landscape setting. So the breeders are right now, you know, helping in coming up with some more tough trees, which are more urban tolerant. Same thing in the landscape setting as well, too, in the garden setting as well, too. So we are finding out a lot of heat-tolerant vegetable crops and varieties as well, too. So, yeah.
Celia in Madison has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Celia.
Hi, good morning. My question is, I've known this is the case in beginning in Britain and in Nebraska for some years, and I've just been told by your producer that Wisconsin now has some vineyards, which I find very interesting. Could this be a new boom industry, and how far north are they right now? And is there anything people should know in terms of protecting them or, you know, temperatures and stuff like that?
So, yes, Wisconsin has a lot of vineyards, actually. I mean, it's not something a new industry, and, you know, it's been there for a while. From way up in Bayfield all the way down, you know, to Kenosha, you know, we do have some vineyards. So you can go to the, you know, Wisconsin Grape Growers Association and check out some of those vineyards and, you know, see some of those vineyards in your locality, what might be nearby. And so, yes. You know, we do have grow some of the, you know, American hybrid, you know, grape varieties. So we have an extension publication that talks in detail about it. Just Google up growing grapes in Wisconsin, UW Extension. You will find an excellent publication that talks in detail about it. In terms of winter protection, grapes are very tough plant, and some of the grape varieties that has been recommended for Wisconsin are very hardy and tough plants as well. So the key thing is proper training and pruning is the most important thing about in growing grape vines. Yeah.
Thanks very much, Celia, for that question. Appreciate it. Vijay Pandian, our guest today, horticulture extension educator. Our technical director today is the man behind the beard, Lee Rayburn, and Jill Nadoza, our producer. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you with us for Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Vijay Pandian, extension horticulture educator. great to have him along as well. And you can join in. Questions, give a call at 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. We'll get you on pretty quickly, so join in. Nancy in Wautoma, it's your turn. Thank you for calling.
Good morning. So I'm from the Racine Kenosha area. I was a master gardener there. Moved up here when I retired, and I brought a huge collection of irises here. I'm on sugar sand, they call it here. Yeah. And so they've been in the ground since the fall of 2020. I am getting, you know, I didn't plant them deep. I knew how to plant them correctly. And I'm only getting a couple blooms. And what I'm also noticing is that as I walk through there, I'm not seeing the rhizomes at the surface the way I did. And I also brought a lot of daffodils and tulips. I have very few left. Are they getting pulled down into that sand with this drought, especially, you know, where the sand is even drier?
Yeah.
And is this pulling my irises down? Do I need to dig them all up and reset them? I probably have 50 plants out there.
Oh, boy.
The first thing I would do is check the rhizome and see how the rhizome, the healthiness of the rhizomes, you know, if you do fine. See, oftentimes, we in Wisconsin, we do have iris borer. And that can really kill some of those rhizomes. And so check around and see if those have any foul smell or any rotting happening up right down there. And if you do find some iris borer, get rid of those infected plant right away. I would suspect that might be one of the primary reasons, you know, why you may not see actually some of those, you know, healthy, you know, irises coming back again. So check it out.
Yeah. And Nancy mentioned water or lack thereof. I'm wondering about watering and how people can do a decent job of watering during these kind of drought conditions that we've had.
See, one thing I know is in sandy soil, you know, water tends to drain out very easily. So think about, you know, incorporating some sort of like a compost. You know, you don't have to mix it up very well in the soil. One of my, you know, favorite master gardener, he used to tell me, and back when I was in Green Bay, that the secret actually of improving the healthiness of a herbaceous perennial is actually spreading the compost around the crown of the plant. And so every spring, he used to bring these big buckets of compost and spread around the base of those plants and about like a 4 to 6 inches. By end of the season, those compost breaks down and adds a little bit of good organic matter. And those things helps in actually, you know, conserving the soil moisture, holding the moisture, and holding the nutrients. So in these type of tough environmental conditions, especially when you're going to have a drought or dry conditions, compost could be a real lifesaver. And, I mean, again, there are other organic matters, like mulching materials can also help in conserving the soil moisture as well, too. So, you know, those kind of things. The other important thing also is that, you know, we need to bring back, again, rain barrels. And, you know, so water is going to be a very precious, you know, element. So think about conserving the water, the rainwater that you collect actually from the roof. And those rainwater could be, you know, used back again on non-edible plants. So, you know, think, get some rain barrels. They are actually easy to make. So start thinking about conserving some water and use those water, you know, to water your herbaceous perennials during the dry season time.
Yeah. And Nancy, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. As long as we're talking about water or the lack thereof, what are some good drought-resistant plants? You know, you talked about some trees, but what about other plants?
So in terms of, like, other plants, like some shrubs, one of my favorite would be is also deer vela. You know, it's a southern bush honeysuckle, and it's also in a not native to Wisconsin, but it's native to the United States. And those are very excellent, you know, drought-tolerant plant. And now there are a lot of different cultivars and varieties of those things as well. Those plants are excellent for median plantings. You can do those things. Or, you know, if you have anything to, like, an accent type of planting, you can also use that. Now, some other cultivars are from, like, you know, dark purple in color to reddish and reddish orange in color. So it has a lot of different varieties these days. So check out some of the, you know, Deer Vela plants. The second thing is actually another one is the chokeberry. That is a red chokeberries and black chokeberries. That is Aronia species. Now, there are different varieties of Aronia species, which are also drought tolerant, takes full sun very easily. And they have exhibit a lot of beautiful fall coloration, like a reddish orange fall coloration. So those are excellent in a drought tolerant plants in terms of shrubs. So again, in terms of herbaceous perennials, we have a lot of, you know, plant species which are more, you know, takes dry conditions very easily. So we have a whole list of those things, plants, from rattlesnake masters to, you know, from sedums, you know. So they all take, you know, dry conditions very easily. So, again, you know, it's a matter of, you know, changing our landscape, changing our garden practices to this changing climate. So we have the tools now. It's not that we are shortage of tools. So it's a matter of, you know, gradually shifting our landscape to this and adapting to this climate change.
Called to ask, couldn't stay with us. When can she take her plants back? She's got some indoor plants. When can she take them back outside? Is it okay to do it now with the warmer weather?
I would exercise more cautious about it. I mean, I do have a lot of indoor plants. And the few things you need to know. The night temperature is a very crucial thing. And it depends upon what type of indoor plants you have. If you're thinking about tropical plants, I would advise no, especially the night temperature is still dropping down to 30s to 40s, you know, so it's not a good thing to do that. And these tropical plants don't like it. So you need to have a minimum about, like, you know, 55, 60 degrees in the outside night temperature. And the daytime temperature should be about, like, you know, 70 to 75 degrees for many of these tropical plants. So some of the subtropical type of plants, you know, yes, maybe they might be able to adapt to about 55 at night temperature. But again, it's not right now a good time. The weather is kind of fluctuating. One week we see a nice sunny day, and the next week it's back again to the cold temperature of less than 30 degrees. So, you know, let the temperature stabilizes, you know, and then you can able to take them out.
Bob from Hidden Valley or Hidden View Winery in Medford emailed to say that regarding grape growing, there's a vibrant number of growers with new varieties coming out of University of Minnesota, varieties for cold climates. And pruning at the moment appears to be in question given the higher temps and lack of dormancy period. Is there any advice for what to look for timing-wise to begin vineyard work?
Well, I mean, I had the same questions too, you know, but some of the, you know, fruit crops, some of the small fruit crops, the buds are already swelling. You know, we usually recommend, you know, late winter, probably, you know, mid to late March to do these pruning since we are 1 month ahead and the buds are already starting to swell. I would say, you know, sooner the better. You know, do it right now. Even if you, you know, the buds are starting to swell, go ahead and schedule the pruning on a clean, nice, sunny day. I mean, you know, right now in southeast part of Wisconsin, we are having some rain and drizzling. So, you know, don't do it on the wet times, but do it doing in the very dry, sunny days, especially when the temperatures are about 30 degrees. You can schedule some of those pruning and of those grape wines. We do have an extension publication that talks about, you know, how to train and prune grape vineyard. Just Google up. You know, growing grapes in Wisconsin, put UWEX, and it leads you directly to our publication.
Usually we prune, obviously, while trees are dormant. I'm wondering about fruit trees. Do they need some special pruning techniques. Is there still time to prune those?
I mean... I mean, we're getting too late. I mean, you know, because the buds are swelling. I mean, last week I hosted a pruning class in Milwaukee. I mean, in a community orchard, and you know, the apples are in a silver tip stage. The buds are actually here in southeast part of Wisconsin, are in silver tip stage. I mean, and the pear buds are swelling quite a bit, and including the cherries, you know, tart cherries and, you know, peaches, the buds are all swelling. And so, I mean, if go ahead and do the pruning, schedule the pruning right now on a clear sunny day, you know, rather than waiting for next month, you know, and the way the forecast is going to be that the temperature is going to keep on progressing up and up. Even the buds are swelling, go ahead and schedule the pruning. Now, Larry, you pointed it right. Pruning ornamental tree, the shade trees are very different compared to pruning a fruit trees. So in fruit trees, the main objective is to, you know, increase in crop production, your fruit production, fruit quality. For that, light is a key factor. So you want to have a plenty of light that goes actually, filters all through the branches, so that you could start producing the flower buds, you know, in all the scaffold and the lateral branches. And so you don't want to have too much crowdness happening up around the central leader of the tree. So the pruning style, training style is very different from a shade tree versus actually a fruit tree crop. So in apples, you know, if you have a dwarf or a semi-dwarf, you need to have a good ladder and you need to have a couple of tiers of scaffold branches. And so we have an extension publication that talks in detail about it. Sometimes seeing is believing, so there are a lot of YouTube videos. Or if any of the local, you know, apple growers or any extension educator hosting any pruning demonstration, go ahead and check it out and attend those things, you know. So get to know actually about all those pruning techniques and training styles of growing and training in apples.
BJ Pandy and our guest, as we talk gardening with him in this changing climate, you may have a question. Maybe something happened to your garden or your trees or shrubs last year, or maybe you want a question about what to look for this year. The number to call, 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us, and the email address, ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Thinking now about starting seeds indoors, we certainly should be able to have started, if you've got something like impatiens or vinca or geraniums or begonias, you could have started those even a few weeks back.
Yes. So, many of these annual flowering plants, you know, you can start some of them, you know, some of the cold, the cold season annual bedding plants, you can start the seed starting right now. Some of the warm season one, I would just still wait, you know. This is like this weather is very unusual, and we are all actually trying to see what's going to happen. And we are trying to learn, actually, you know, is this going to be the pattern that we're going to see down the years? Usually in the past, we recommend even to start the cool season crops, like, you know, starting from seeds, like from broccolis, cauliflowers, right around like mid-March. And so, if you do want to start them, yes. But if you're thinking about warm season crops and including the annuals, you know, from warm season annuals, from petunias, as well as, you know, vegetable crops like tomatoes and peppers, be patient. I would start them, you know, probably like, you know, mid-April to late April, you know, those things. We don't know how the weather is actually going to dictate us, you know. Who knows whether next month it's going to be in 70s or something. Again, be patient, but yes, you can absolutely start some of the cool season crops in a seed starting right now. Yes.
Absolutely. You got cabbage, celery, you got cauliflower, you got head lettuce, you got parsley. I think all those could be started.
Yeah. And in fact, last week I started this, trying to grow some sweet potatoes from the tubers. So I placed it in my seed starting room and they're starting to actually produce some of those, slips. And because they take a while actually to get those kind of decent slips. So, yeah.
Mike emailed to remind folks that garlic mustard is going to be flowering earlier this year as well, and you need to pull them earlier. Can you talk a bit about controlling garlic mustard?
Absolutely. I mean, so with this climate change that's happening up, with all this goofy weather that's happening up, so if that is one particular plant species that's going to gain benefit out of all of this, it's the invasive species. So they're going to have a longer growing season as well, too, which means they're going to compete a lot with our native species, and they're going to outgrow them, produce us, you know, more seeds. Usually garlic mustard will start to bloom, so probably late April, early May. So now with the soil temperature has been increasing. So last week when I checked my soil temperature, it was like 45 degrees. Can you believe that? I could easily plant some of the cool season crops, if the night temperature is not threatening that much, when the soil temperature is going to hit at 55, 60 degrees, you're going to see actually these garlic mustard seeds, starting to germinate very quickly. And some of the second year, garlic mustard plants will start to bolt, when the temperature is going to hit, temperature is going to be at 65, they're going to start to bolt. And, so again, we may have to be very cautious about, how this all going to impact, some of the invasive species plant like garlic mustard. So if you do, I would recommend actually pulling those garlic mustard plant, especially the second year plant that's about to bolt. I can't tell precisely, what month it's going to bloom these days. Pull them up, put them in a black plastic bag, let it get cooked. So don't tend to mound them. So, because these plants actually, even if you tend to mound them, they will start to, they're more adaptive. They'll start to even bolt and start to quickly set the seeds as well too. So put them back again in a black plastic bag and then you, put it as a label for a landfill invasive plant and you trash it. Yes.
Esty in Madison, we'll give you a chance now. Thank you for calling.
Thank you so much. So I have a peach tree that last year leaned so much to one side that it ended up pretty much falling. The roots came up, and with the help of a friend, we were able to pull it back and to bury the roots again. And it seems to be doing okay, in the sense that, it's alive, it seems to have buds and all that. But now all the branches are leaning in the direction in which it fell last year. I mean, there's practically no branches on the other side. So when I look at it and try to think how to prune it, I have no idea what to do. So I hope you have an idea.
So I'm glad that you prop back actually the peaches, peach tree back again. So I would say, install a stake, a tea stake, a metallic tea stake, and try to prop it back again, to straight. At the same time, I would also mulch around your peach tree, because the reason why I'm saying is that, since the peaches are not technically truly hardy for Wisconsin. That was used to be the recommendation in the past. Now, with this changing weather, they're going to be hardy. And one of the, varieties like Reliance is hardy for southern Wisconsin. So I would still mulch them, because the roots of the peaches, the root stalk of the peach, they are not super hardy compared to the Scion, which is the above ground portion. So mulching can help in insulating them. So mulch it first, And second of all, you know, if there are certain branches that has been, you know, imbalancing the crown, so I would tend to scale some of those branches back. Now, again, I don't know what type of training the tree has gone through in the past. If he never trained it before, then probably tend to spread out, actually, your pruning stub for 2 to 3 years. Don't tend to do all the pruning and trying to correct the branches, you know, in a single year. So if those, you know, lateral branches, you know, have been leaning towards one direction, towards the light, just tend to scale them down a little bit, okay, not too much. At the same time, remove any of the water sprouts or any downward growing branches, prune those things out. So peaches, normally we train them by open leader system where, you know, you don't let the grower have a strong central leader. We cut the leader off. And we train those main scaffold branches in more like a V shape, so the light and the yard movement take place around it. And from that, we turn, you know, selectively allow some a few lateral branches, few water sprouts to grow. So any water sprouts or any lateral branches that's crowding the middle of the crown, we cut them down. So that's a proper way of pruning and training a peach tree. So now, in your circumstances, if you feel that your, one of your branches has been leaning towards in one direction and starting to dominate it, scale them down a little bit. And you may want to extend some of the pruning for multiple years, 2 to 3 years. Don't do it all of a sudden. Again, we do have an extension publication that talks in detail about training and pruning of peaches. I highly recommend you. So the name of the publication is called Growing Apricots, Peaches, and Cherries in Wisconsin. Just put it in Google and type in UWEX. That will bring you that details of that publication.
Esty, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Linda emailed to ask when and how to prune evergreens.
Well, that's a good question. I mean, evergreens, in a depending on what type of evergreens that you have, whether it's a, you know, needle evergreens or broadleaf evergreens, okay. So if you're thinking about, like, you know, like a conifer-based one, which are, produces the needles, they don't need that much of, you know, pruning or shearing or any of those kind of things on those type of conifer-based evergreens. So during in the springtime, if you do have a dwarf conifers, you know, you can actually prune some of those candles, the candles of the new growth that comes on the tip of terminal ends of the branches. So you can cut those new candles about half or, you know, a three-fourth, okay, and you can still maintain the dwarf characteristic of it. So those are the conifer-based evergreens that you can do. But in terms of a broadleaf evergreens, like boxwoods and yews, you can shear them, including the arborvitaes, you can shear them, you know, when you start to see some of the new growth happening up, you shear about, you know, half or three-fourths of the new growth, and you can tend to contain them. So those are the things. But don't shear junipers. You know, people make a wrong mistake of shearing the junipers. Junipers don't have the latent bud or the dormant bud like yews and the boxwood. So shearing would make it worse on junipers.
BJ Pandian, our guest today, horticulture extension educator for Kenosha, Milwaukee, and Racine counties. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Garden Talk on Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here with my guest, BJ Pandian, horticulture extension educator for Kenosha, Milwaukee, and Racine counties. Great to have him back. Certainly you can join in. We got open lines. Get you on real quick. The number to call with your garden question, 1-800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Or shoot us an email. The email address, ideas@wpr.org. ideas@wpr.org. Mark in New Glarus emailed to say his fruit trees were girdled last year and died. He saved one sucker from each and is hoping they'll be useful, even if just for grafting, and wonders, will the rootstock be the same on a sucker as the original tree? Any suggestions?
Well, it depends upon where those suckers are coming from. So voles and rabbits could actually girdle, you know, the plant. And so if those side shoots, the suckers that's coming up above the graft union, then your rootstock is still alive, and the rootstock is the one actually that's going to, you know, dictate, okay, whether it's a dwarfing characteristics or, you know, it's a precocious blooming characteristics. All those things it can be able to dictate on the new sucker that's coming up. But if the new sucker is coming up actually down from the ground, directly from the rootstock, then probably you're not going to have the same characteristic like the scion, which used to produce as a crop, you know, in the previous years. It's not going to exhibit the one. So in those cases, you can use those suckers that is coming from the directly from the ground only for grafting purpose, for making as a rootstock for another type of varieties or something like that. So generally, in the, you know, we don't recommend actually, you know, if it's a girdle, just get rid of it. Plant something new one, you know. There are a lot of new and improved varieties of rootstock and, you know, scions are available, you know, depending on what type of crops you're dealing with. So, for example, apples have a lot of new rootstock from Geneva-based rootstock, which are very disease-resistant. So give a try with those kind of things. So, you know, So it depends upon where the sucker's coming from.
Patty emailed, she has a 7 to 10 year old Macintosh apple tree that has never had a blossom on it. It's planted in good sun, good soil. There are wild apple trees within a good distance from it. What do you suggest?
Well, it may have to do with the rootstock sometimes. Say there are three different types of rootstock. I mean, four different types of rootstock, we'll say. So there's a dwarf, semi-dwarf, and there is also, you know, the standard one. And there is also another type of rootstock. We don't grow them typically in Wisconsin, you know, but generally the dwarf and a semi-dwarf one, you know, triggers a blooming about three years or something. Even some of the dwarf one will start to bloom right away in the second year producing the crop. Semi-dwarf takes 3 years. Standard types, which are usually grafted on Dolga crabs and stuff like that, they takes about like, you know, 5 to 6 years. So I'm afraid, you know, that those Macintosh apples might have been grafted on a standard rootstock, you know, that's why it might be taking a while for them to, you know, produce any blossom. Second of all, I would also, you know, check around and see, you know, if you do a good job in pruning. Letting too many water sprouts, too many leafy ones, you know, can also, you know, produce, you know, lesser amount of bloom. So do something up about pruning, let some more light and yeah, get into it. But the prime thing, check what type of rootstock you have. If you have a standard rootstock, it takes about like, you know, 5 to 6 years for the tree to bloom.
Susan emailed, her seeds, their plants are now 3 inches high from the seed. What does she do now? She's afraid they're going to be too lanky when it's okay to put them outside.
Yeah, I mean, did she mention what type of seed or what type of plant?
No, she didn't. I was looking for that, too.
Okay. Well, let's assume that, you know, she started tomatoes a little bit early, okay? If you do have these kind of like a tropical warm season type of, you know, plants that you start a little bit early, they're going to get definitely lucky. You know, they're going to be in search of light and, you know, they're going to get more leggy. So a couple of things you can do. One, you can try to transplant them in a bigger size container if possible, and make sure to keep up with the water and the nutrients. Because once the plant's starting to get bigger, you know, they're going to suck a lot of moisture and nutrients. And try to keep them actually, you know, a little bit in a cooler place, okay? See, because sometimes the temperature also triggers actually to produce some more foliage and more growth. But if you do give out a little bit of a cooler temperature, it kind of slows the growth, okay? Keep your night temperature at about like 65 and day temperature at 70 degrees, and try to place it underneath a little bit of more light, you know, and actually try to do some repotting every other week, you know, to make sure they're alive. And you may want to actually fertilize them as well, too, because once the plant started to get about more than 6 inches, it's going to speed up, and you're going to start to see some blossoms happening up as well, too. If you do see some blossoms happening up, pinch those blossoms, okay? I know it might be inhumane, but, you know, that's good for the plant because they're going to suck a lot of nutrients to produce any fruits or anything like that, you know. Then you can think about planting in a container. So here's a good thing about Larry that I really like, actually, is that since we're having a longer growing season, we may have a little bit of an early spring. Planting in a containers might be, or in a planter boxes might be a good option. So when we do have like few days of sunny weather, about temperature more than like 65, 70 degrees, you can bring those container grown plants outside and place them in a sunny one. At the night temperature, when it drops down, you can bring them back inside the garage. Or one of the best tools for the gardeners is a floating row cover. Floating row cover, or called as a remake cloth, is a polyester spun bound material. And they give you about like a 5 degree of warmness, okay, to the plant. So in the evening hours, you can drape it on top of the plant. If it gets really cold, about like 50 to 55 night temperature, you can put it on top of the plant, use your warmness. But again, you know, planting in a containers and planter boxes would be really a lifesaver, especially if you start the seeds too early. You can bring them back and forth from the garage, outside, back and forth, yeah.
You mentioned fertilizer, and that reminded me of houseplants. And, you know, typically in the winter, we hold back on fertilizing houseplants. Is this about the time we want to... resume a fertilizer program for our houseplants?
Well, the sunny weather, in a few weeks, we tend to expect some sunny weathers, and, you know, and we usually keep some of the houseplants close to the southern-facing windows, and they start to produce some new leaves. I've been growing some figs, actually, as a houseplant, and they're starting to produce some leaves. And, in fact, one of the figs actually started to produce some cute little kind of fruit as well, too, on its one of the sidebars. So once your houseplant's starting to awake and starting to produce a new set of leaves, you can actually fertilize them. You know, you can add some sort of slow release fertilizers, you know, to those houseplants. Not a fast release, but a slow release one, yes.
So not heavy in the nitrogen side.
The nitrogen is a two-part. That is, it's fast-releasing nitrogen, slow-releasing nitrogen. So you need to have a slow-releasing nitrogen. Fertilizer like Osmocote, which releases the nitrogen very slowly, trickles down. So those kind of power fertilizer you need to use.
BJ Pandian, our guest today. You can join in, too. I'm a little quiet today. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us. The email address, ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Wondering about mulch. You don't want to remove that mulch too early. Is now, given the temperatures, if you got a lot of mulch out there, should we be removing any mulch now?
I would not do that. We have to observe the weather and see how it's going to be. But so far, what we have learned so far is that we are experiencing a fluctuating temperature. One week, it seems like, you know, spring is here at 65 and things are about to boom. And the other week, it's like back again, you know, to a late winter in a very early spring and still cold. And that really fluctuating type of temperature, you know, is gonna, causing some of the buds and some of the roots and everything to awake. So we need to protect the root system no matter what to this fluctuating temperature. And mulch is a good insulator. So let the temperature stabilizes, you know, to about 60 to 65 degree for a week, okay? And then you can gradually remove those excess mulch around the base of the plant. Until then, let it be that. It's not going to kill the plant. And, you know, at the same time, you know, you don't want to remove them too early, because when you do remove early, you're going to expose those roots, and suddenly if the temperature drops to 20 degrees, that's really actually going to kill some of those root systems. You know, as the soil starts to heave in, some of the roots, some of the cold temperature is going to get into those cracked soil, and that's going to affect the root system.
Patrick in Madison, what's on your mind?
Hi, thanks for taking the call. Yeah, I just have a question. I planted, 70 or so arborvitae 30 years ago, and they've gotten actually taller than I would prefer them, and I'm just wondering what flexibility I have to shrink them, and whether that can be done at all, or...
Can you shrink those arborvitae?
Say, if you do have like a tall arborvitae that is, you know, above and beyond what you can able to maintain it, yes, you could actually, you know, slowly, you know, gradually cut down some of those, you know, leaders. So many of these arborvitaes, upright arborvitae, have some multiple leaders growing around. So every year, scale some of those arborvitaes, you know, gradually down and to a height that you want. Now, one thing I would caution is that don't make any like a cookie cut type of cutting on the top of it. We call it like a topping. Don't make those kind of like a straight, you know, horizontal cut, you know, make it more like a topping. You know, that's the worst thing you can do to ruin the beauty of your arborvitae. So
don't do that. Vijay Pandian, our guest, horticulture extension educator for Kenosha, Milwaukee, and Racine Counties. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on Wisconsin Public Radio. Joining us today for Garden Talk, Larry Mueller here. We're talking with Vijay Pandian, horticulture educator for UW Extension in Kenosha, Milwaukee, and Racine Counties. Gardening questions? Give a call. The number's 800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. And let's take a call from Pete in Wautoma. Pete, thank you for calling.
Hello, thank you for taking that call. I have a number of different compost samples that a farmer actually wants to sell me, and I'm wondering the value, if I could get some testing done, take samples of these and test them to a lab somewhere to get samples done for the nutritive value, and what should we be looking for in compost? Thank you.
Okay.
That's a wonderful question. Yes, UW's soil testing lab can also test the compost as well, the nutrients in the compost as well. So go to UW soil testing lab in Madison, you know, so all those informations are online. So just type in UW Madison soil test lab, and so that you could able to send the sample directly to the lab. So in the compost, they will test you what is your organic matter content, phosphorus content, potassium content, what is your soil, the compost pH content in it. Now, one thing about compost is that depending upon what type of, you know, raw materials they use for composting, your nitrogen value could vary. But thing is that the nitrogen is generally is very minimum in compost. So if you have an assumption that the compost is going to be providing a supplemental nutrients for your plant and things, especially for nitrogen, no, it is not. So it's going to be having a very little value to it. And that too varies depending on what type of raw materials. Now, soil test lab generally don't provide the nitrogen value because the nitrogen is very dynamic and it changes, you know, very easily. But they will test you for phosphorus, potassium, organic matter content, as well as for your pH content. pH tells you, you know, whether your compost is an acid type or, you know, alkaline type. So generally, most of the composts are more like an alkaline or base type thing, okay? So those are primary things the soil test report was going to tell you about the quality of your compost, okay?
Good question. Thank you. Phyllis in the town of Dunn, we'll go to you. Hi, Phyllis.
Hi. So I was calling in response to the person who said she planted her seeds too early and what could she do. Well, first of all, I just think she should consider just getting rid of them and starting over because most of the seed packets do tell you don't start till April or some later. But we, so I used to lead a group called Fitchburg Fields, and we had a food pantry garden of about a tenth of an acre, and we grew so much food there. But we grew the seedlings at my house, and we don't have a greenhouse. So my husband just had set up lights, just you could have four flats under lights. And we grew 1,500 one year. And so how could we do that? Because such a small space. As soon as they had to be separated and repotted, then we would put up these mini hoop houses, which one of our members had invented, I think. And just, it's like 3 feet wide and 5 feet long, and it's like a Quonset hut, but it's just like a giant screen, you could say.
Mm-hmm.
And then we would put at night, put a concrete curing blanket over it and a plastic sheet. And so it's a lot of work, but you can grow food that way. You can grow your seedlings. You have to babysit them. You can't go away for 3 hours at a time because you can vent it when it's warm, and then you can cover it up if it's too cold. But these things change a lot. But it is a great method.
Phyllis, thank you so much. Comment, VJ.
Absolutely. I mean, if I was actually in that caller, you know, if I'm starting to grow, I mean, if I have some seedlings that is actually so spindly and, you know, I started so early, I mean, if it's just one or two of them, I would just trash it too. I would really agree with that. But everyone has his own emotional sentiment. You know, if you have a kid and it's the first time they're starting it, I can't tell them go to trash it. But I agree, you know. But I really like the idea, actually, too, about, you know, having this kind of mini hoop house and many, you know, box stores selling those things right now. And ideally, those are excellent, you know, staging platform for hardening these plants. And if you start them a little bit early, just to provide a little bit of a greenhouse effect, you know, it does provide those things. Back in my graduate school days, my advisor, we grow some tomatoes for testing. And so we grow them in a large quantities, like thousands in a flat. So we don't have a room to, you know, scoop it out from the cell, the individual, you know, 1-inch cell back into like, you know, 4-inch pot. So we start these seeds a bit late. So generally in tomatoes, we start like around like, you know, mid to late April and transplant them around close to end of May. So my advisor when I was in grad school, you know, we don't have that much room, but we still have to grow these thousands of tomatoes, you know, for testing. So we start them actually growing in the cell a little bit late, even like around like first or second week in May. And we maintain them in the cell, in the 72 cells, you know, till about like end of June, till it gets about like a 3 or 4 inch tall. And then we harden them for 1 week, and then we plant them around like first or second week in June. So you might think that, oh, my God, that's like, you know, baby plants. How are they going to adapt to it and whether they're going to produce? Is it too light? No, tomatoes are very adaptive. They will quickly grow, actually, once it, you know, outdoor temperature stabilizes. So it doesn't matter if it's like a 6-inch plant or if it's actually like, you know, a 12-inch plant. You know, so they will quickly capture and they'll be still able to grow by end of the summer season. They'll be almost equal in height and they'll start to produce a fruit at the same time.
Mm. And Phyllis, thank you so much for calling. You can join in too, 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.com. jennifer@peachtree.org. Jennifer emailed to ask, what kind of soil should she put in her raised bed? Sounds like she's starting a raised bed.
That's a very good question. And so there are like a two different type of media that you can use. So one media is composed of, like, you know, 1:1 compost and topsoil, good quality topsoil. You can go 1:1 ratio. The key thing about is in this type of media is that topsoil over the time settles down back again. So every time, you know, you need to put some new compost and use again garden trowel, you need to tend to flip it up and loosen it up. But the good thing is that it doesn't dry out that easily. And your height of your raised bed matters a lot too. You need to have minimum 10-inch, 12-inch height. Now, the second type of media is purely compost and peat mixed into it. This is a soilless media, you know, compost and peat 1:1 ratio. You can mix it. Now, this media, you don't have to, you don't need to use any garden trowel or anything that's, you know, to mix it up. Every spring, if it's media settled down, so you can keep adding some more compost into it too. Now, the downside about this second type of media is that it dries out very easily. So you may want to make sure that during the dry season time, maybe water like once or twice, you know, one in the morning, one in the evening time, you may want to water it. So, yeah.
There we go. Perry in Oconto has something for us. Hi, Perry.
Yes, I have to do a total prune on a tree. I have to cut it down because it's getting too close to the house. It's probably at least 4 inches in diameter. And any thoughts or tips to get rid of that stump as easy as possible?
Yeah.
Do you know what type of tree you're talking about?
It's a maple tree.
Oh, okay, the notorious maple tree. I mean, it's a good idea. I'm glad that you're actually thinking about cutting it down as it's too close to the house. Okay, yes. So maples tend to have some notorious root system, you know, especially if it's a silver maple, you know. So when you do some basal cutting, okay, and if you do paint the stump with some, like, you know, concentrated, you know, glyphosate or any type of, you know, herbicides to it, it's not, you're not going to kill it right away in the very first, you know, during the growing season. So in the fall, I would actually, you know, paint the stump, actually make a fresh cut again, and then paint the stump actually with the concentrated glyphosate, because the glyphosate in the fall season, you know, translocate to the root system. So the question comes to, do I have to wait till the fall? Can I still actually, you know, weaken the plant right now? Yes. Whenever you're going to see some new suckering, or if you want to spray some of the new suckers that's coming up, you can go ahead, or you can keep on cutting them down. And so once you're able to weaken the plant in the fall, make sure that, you know, you make a fresh cut again to the stump, and then, you know, paint it with some concentrated glyphosate, and that will really, you know, kill them up. Once the stump has been killed, once the root system is killed, then you can either actually grind them back, or, you know, you can either try to find a way to get, you know, get it off the ground.
Thank you, Perry. Appreciate it. David emailed, they had to take down a small maple tree in their front yard that had some of its branches' leaves turning brown after a few seasons. The tree they replaced it with also died. Trees grow fine in their yard except for this one specific location. A neighbor taking gardening classes suggested they might have verticillium wilt in their soil. If a soil test comes back positive for verticillium wilt, can the soil be treated to get rid of it?
That's a good question. Say, when you're thinking about considering planting a large tree, a large shade, large size shade trees like maples and things, please consider, take into consideration the proximity, you know, of this tree to any, you know, house or to a driveway or to any other infrastructures that you have, including your electrical lines, gas lines, you know, sewage, and all those things. Generally, tend to place this large-sized maple trees and everything 30 feet away from all these infrastructures, minimum 30 feet, because these trees gets really huge and like about 50, 60 feet tall, and, you know, spreads actually about like 30, 40 feet wide. So to avoid this type of long-term issues, try to make sure that you plant the right side, right tree for the right landscape. Generally, it's best to go with some like small size tree that gets about 15, 20 feet tall, those kind of trees. Now, springing back again to the question about, you know, whether your tree is, you know, if you plant the same species back again, the likely chances that they are, they're going to get infected. But the best thing to do, if you find actually any of this species that has been declining, you know, in the same spot, send a sample to Dr. Brian Huddleston, Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic Director. So you can find his website with the information on how to send the samples, you know, what type of samples you need to send. So send a sample and, you know, he will get it tested, you know, to see what type of pathogen is infecting. So generally maples, yes, they are all succumb to Verticillium wilt. Verticillium wilt is a systemic disease. It affects the vascular system of your plant. And that causes, in the middle of the summertime, your leaves to turn brown, the branches to suddenly wilt, you know, those things. So Verticillium wilt, whether it's persistent in the soil, it, you know, or right on the spot. So usually Verticillium wilt, there are a lot of different type of strains, and every strain is very host specific. So if you plant again another maple, yes, definitely the chances is very likely. But if you plant a different species, generally, you know, it won't actually affect that much. So again, the first step is to get it actually tested. And once a test comes positive or negative, Dr. Brian Hilson can give you some more recommendations.
Yep. The UW Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic. Mary emailed, she's been able to grow 4 Kentucky coffee trees from seed. They're inside now in 4x6 containers. What does she feed these trees? How does she know when to increase the container size? And how many years to keep them inside before she sets them outside free?
Well, I mean, Kentucky coffee tree is an awesome plant, and so it's a dioecious plant, which means that's a male plant and a female plant. So the female plant is the one that produces a pod, and you know, and you collect the pod, and in the fall, and you stratify them. You know, basically is that, you know, you subject them to a cold temperature for a few months, okay, and then soak them in the water, and then you plant them to germinate. And so, but the problem is that, you know, trying to grow them from seed is that you don't know whether it's a male tree or a female tree. Because a female tree produces a pod, but if you don't care about it, yes, go ahead and do it, plant it. Now, if you already germinated, let them grow actually in the container. You know, you let them produce some about like 6 inches of growth. And then you transfer them into 1 gallon type of container, keep them in a bright sunny window until, you know, probably in the late in the springtime, you can take them back outside and, you know, you can actually plant them right away. So you don't have to babysit it for multiple years trying to, you know, grow this small seedling, you know. So I would plant them, you know, let them, you know, grow them to about like 6 inches and then plant them right away. They will grow much, you know, a little bit more decent. They get a lot of light, and they will able to survive and adapt to the winter conditions, and then they can able to grow a little bit longer. Furthermore, you know, so you don't necessarily have to babysit these seedlings.
She also wanted to know if she can snip her red osier dogwood plants and plant the tops to have more bushes.
So these kind of, you know, stem cuttings, you know, yes, you can actually make these stem cuttings. So when you do make these stem cuttings, you take actually a 4-inch container or, you know, fill it with some potting media, especially like, you know, peat-based potting media. You take this fresh, you know, cutting, you know, depends upon what type of cutting. If it's a softwood or like a, you know, semi, you know, hardwood. If it's a softwood cuttings, you know, you can directly, you know, put them in here, you know, the 4-inch container filled with a potting media, and you can cover it with some, like, a plastic, you know, wrap around to it to hold the humidity. And so that humidity and the temperature, about 70 to 75 degree minimum, will help actually in producing the roots on the softwood. If it's a semi-hardwood one, maybe you want to make sure to dip it in a root hormones, okay? And then you put it actually in a 4-inch container water it, and then put up a plastic wrap around to it, and so that it can trap the humidity and place it in the warmer place, so it can actually, you know, boost the the root development. So yes, you can do it, but you need to start it indoor first and let it, once it get rooted, when it start producing new buds, then you can take them outside and plant them.
And Patricia emailed, she has a nine-foot ficus alee in a 24-inch planter. This tree is really pot-bound. Can she cut back the roots, or does she need to keep enlarging the pot size?
That's a good question. I mean, and in my main administration office, they had also have a huge ficus plant. This was about, like, I would say at least minimum about like a 10 feet tall. And it spreads about like about another 10 feet. You know, it's a huge, humongous one. And they have a very bright, sunny window. And it's been in actually a giant container for a long period of time. So, once the plant has been stable. So this is one of the beauty of this tropical plant, like ficus and, you know, a few other plants. Even though if it's a root bound on a large size container, they can still survive. So you don't have to think about chopping those roots and things like that. And at the same time, as a gardener, as a homeowner, sometimes we may not have actually, you know, accessibility to get some large size container, you know, try to do some repotting. You know, it's a humongous task. So one thing you can do in the springtime, you can selectively prune some of the branches. You don't want to have too many branches and stuff like that. So you can selectively prune few branches, okay, and, you know, clean them up, give some good light and good aeration around the plant. You don't necessarily have to prune any of those roots, but if you have the resource and capacity, you can do some repotting into a larger container, fill in some from fresh soils and stuff like that, yes.
We got a note that the 7th annual Michael Fields Community Seed Swap is this Saturday, March 9th, 11 a.m. to 3 p.m., It's on Townline Road of East Troy, and it's a free community seed swap. And if you don't have any seeds to bring, there's no problem. This is a free community seed swap. There's plenty of seeds to go around. So 11 to 3, March 9th, at Townline Road, East Troy. And there's a few of those around. Michael Fields does a good job.
Awesome. Yes. I mean, a lot of, you know, local community gardeners and garden clubs, they're actually, you know, doing all the seed swap. And they also have a lot of libraries. Nowadays, they have a seed library as well, too. So it's a very nice and innovative way, actually, you know, not only actually encourage the new gardeners to plant some new plants. At the same time, you know, also a great place to, you know, gather around and exchange some, you know, exotic seeds, and as well as to find some exotic varieties. And you can also test it out in your garden. So, and you don't have to, you know, buy a huge quantities. You know, you can selectively, you know, pick and choose, you know, very few seeds and that is necessary for your garden. So, so now is the time for the gardeners actually to start thinking about getting some all kind of educational information, gathering all the resources now. And of course, Extension is actually having a lot of, you know, educational classes online for free. And in fact, I'm also hosting a garden conference next week on March 16th called Spring into the Gardening. And it's down and going to be in Bristol and Kenosha as well too. So check out actually a local garden club, you know, extension offices, and inquire about all wonderful gardening resources and informations.
BJ, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. We'll look forward to another visit. Thank you very much.
BJ, thank you.
Yeah, BJ Pandian, horticulture educator for UW Extension in Kenosha, Milwaukee, and Racine counties. Just looking ahead, Jesse LeGrew will be with us on Monday to talk about the security of doorbell cameras and also notifications. That's Monday starting at 11. In the meantime, thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store. I'm Larry Mueller.